Hi, folks. Denise Howell here, along with my co-host, Sarah Pearson, and our guests, Clark AC and Kat Walsh. We're going to be right here for you on This Week in Law next. None of us is wearing enough makeup, really, to get in front of a Lily camera, but we're all wearing way too much to get into the startup castle. The NSA is under fire from Congress and the courts, and we're going to talk about the state of open source next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 303, recorded May 15th, 2015. Charmingly earnest, yet insufferable. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all of the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. I'm so excited that you've joined us this week. We've got just a spectacular panel and some really meaty stories to get into at the intersection of technology and law, which is what we do here on the show. So without further ado, let me introduce you to our panel. My co-host Sarah is with us, Sarah Pearson, lawyer at Creative Commons. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Denise. I'm very excited for today's show.
I'm very excited, too. Great to see you again. Joining us is a former colleague of Sarah's at Creative Commons, was counsel there for a bit, went on to the Wikimedia Foundation, where she worked for a while and also was chair of the organization for a year, I believe, and just this year has been appointed to the board of the Free Software Foundation, and this is Kat Walsh. Hello, Kat.
Hi, Denise. It's great to join you today.
Great to have you joining us. Thank you so much. And also joining us, another person with a strong interest in free software, so you can discern that we'll probably be talking about that on the show, is Clark Acey. Clark is currently a professor at BYU School of Law. He's also taught at Penn State and has worked at Amazon in the past and also the renowned Silicon Valley law firm of Wilson Sonsini Goodrich & Rosati. Hello, Clark.
Hi, great to be here.
Great to see you. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Lots to discuss, as I said. Lots been going on. Some things we've been tabling to get into when we had the right panel and ample time. So now is that time. Let's start out on the copyright front and talk a bit about open source. So there have been a number of stories in the news lately, sort of flying the banner of open source, celebrating how well the open source software movement has done over the years, that it has been a major force in the technology industry. And I think there's just no arguing that open source, which started out in one of the pieces that we have highlighted in our topics this week, there was a reminder that Microsoft at one point called open source software a cancer. And now it has very much pivoted and is embracing open source to the point not only where it's open sourcing many of its own products, but is thinking, actually flirting with the notion, saying we haven't ruled out and anything could happen, the thought of open sourcing Windows. So we definitely have seen a big move there. And with Clark and Kat's background in open source, I'd just love to get your guys, sitting back all these years later, perspective on the development of open source software and its acceptance, where it is today and where it's going. Those are all big questions, and we can drill down and get into more detail. But Kat, why don't, since you definitely working at Wikimedia and the Free Software Foundation, why don't we start with you on this?
Sure. So I think it started out as this thing that was just a couple of weirdos off doing this, you know, off doing this thing. Maybe it would catch on, maybe it wouldn't. And you didn't have to pay attention to them. You could keep doing your proprietary strategy and kind of ignore what was going on in the free software and open source world. Now it's become so mainstream that whether you accept its philosophies or not, that you have to figure out how to deal with it. You have to work with it. And I think we're seeing that a lot more as even the big software companies are figuring out, spending a lot of energy and figuring out how to work with open source. And through that, coming to see, maybe at least see some of its benefits for themselves, come to embrace it a little bit. I think that's only going to happen more and more in the future, particularly as everybody comes onto it. You can't be a holdout anymore. You can't not embrace it yourself.
Right. And the interesting thing that has happened with open source is companies that have embraced it have shown other companies that they could still make money off the products that they've open sourced, that it actually assists their business model. Right now on the screen, if you're watching the video, is a piece. Ironically, that picture at the top, I was assuming that the picture might involve a Creative Commons image, but that one is a Shutterstock image. But I think that is Simon Phipps's piece, maybe. I can't really see. So Simon Phipps, I've met before. He's a great guy. Has been writing at InfoWorld for some time and has done a special column on open source for InfoWorld. And this piece published just last week, it's sort of his goodbye to that column because he says, no, I'm still going to be writing about open source, but it has become so mainstream that we're not giving it special coverage anymore here at InfoWorld. We're just, you know, it permeates everything we do, which I thought was an interesting way for him to conclude his column and sort of a celebratory way with all the balloons there. So I think that this is sort of across the board what we're seeing in the industry. As Kat says, people have to learn to deal with it if they're not embracing all of the philosophies. But there's far more to do than just deal with it, right, Clark? Those who do embrace it and use it are finding that its potential to help not just the world, but the capitalist company is very great, correct?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, it's one thing, sort of this old mode, I think, that Kat was describing, where companies were a little more fearful of it, right? And so you have these extensive review policies and procedures, and you're really trying to avoid it in a lot of cases. That's sort of, you know, That's a historical artifact, I think. The companies that do sort of keep with that stance with respect to open source won't be around very long. They won't succeed because there's so much innovation and so much collaboration that accelerates that innovation in the open source world, not only in software, but in a lot of other domains as well, that, you know, if you don't join in and figure out how to take advantage of these vast software and other resources and be a part of that broader community, I just think you put yourself at such a disadvantage that you're going to struggle to succeed. And as more and more different software projects and different layers of software build viable open source free software solutions, you see a lot of the, you know, the still proprietary pieces of software disappear, and their viability just sort of, right, goes the way of the earth. So, you know, Microsoft, for instance, I think, I don't recall exactly the percentages, but I think they were the second or third largest contributor per lines of code to the Linux kernel in recent years. So, you know, even Microsoft, the long maligned enemy of free software and open source software, is, you know, seeding ground and saying this is the way the world is.
Right. Let's get into the legal nuts and bolts of how free software works for just a bit. Obviously, the GNU public license, the GPL, is a very well-known one, very closely aligned with the Free Software Foundation. There are other free software licenses out there. And, you know, whatever flavor of license you pick, the way that free software works is you decide, okay, I'm going to write this code. It's sort of, for those who are more familiar with Creative Commons, because we talk about it a lot on the show and have done a number of great tips. If you're not as familiar with the software licenses, they work similarly. You pick which license you like based on, you know, what you want people doing with your software, and you put it out into the world, and then they don't have to come to you every time they want to use it. But that doesn't mean that you stop development of whatever it is that you're making, that you stop making improvements, etc. And so that's one way in which people continue to realize a financial benefit from something that they put out, if they're, you know, continuing to issue the official version of the software. But one of the things that was a cause of hand-wringing early on with the free software movement, and people expected the other shoe to drop on this in dramatic ways and put an end to the growth and rise of it that we've seen, it really hasn't played out that way, is the fact that you get lots of people contributing to the code that can be the official code. And you get branches and forks and things, and that becomes problematic, but it seems manageable in one way or another. But one of the things that always caught me was this notion that people are giving a representation and warranting when they're contributing code that all of the code that they are contributing is original and they haven't lifted it from somewhere else. So it's this notion of making sure that, you know, you are big company X and you've decided you're going to use open source software. You don't want to get sued by someone along the way. You have that little bit of uncertainty that all of the contributors have really done all of their due diligence and have really been forthcoming when they've contributed to the code. That really hasn't wound up being a big concern, has it, Kat?
Not that I've seen. And one thing I want to say is that people have this concern. It comes most to the fore when you're thinking about free software, but it's not unique to that. We see this in proprietary software also. You don't know that your developers didn't just lift something from Stack Overflow or that they found somewhere else. It just becomes a little bit more obvious when you're auditing everything for the licensing status to begin with that you don't assume it was all produced in-house. So that's not really something that that we've seen too much.
All right. That's what I thought too. Clark, do you feel differently? Have there been big cases out there that I've missed where someone has, obviously there have been some cases about software genesis and some attempts to recover based on the fact that, hey, you're... my code is in your stuff and it's not, you're not paying me for it. But overall, do you see that as a problem that has developed at all or will be a problem going forward?
I think historically it definitely hasn't been a problem, at least that right has gained a lot of media attention, or that where companies have discovered code being stolen and then sort of put into some open source project. I think part of the reason for that, or part of the reason that hasn't become a huge concern, is a lot of the code that is contributed to these major projects is coming from corporations, right, that are very careful about these types of issues. And so they have extensive policies in place and talk about all sorts of negatives that result from those policies. But they may be, I think, a factor in limiting these types of legal issues from arising. And, I mean, if someone... you know, some independent developer contributes some code to some project, the likelihood is, if they have taken it from somewhere, it's from another open source project, not from, Microsoft's proprietary code that they've sort of reverse engineered and pulling apart and now have dumped it into some open source software project. So you know, I think there are a lot of reasons why that issue hasn't arisen much and isn't much of a concern. It's mostly a concern, I think, for lawyers and one of the fears that, as you mentioned, has been sort of raised time and time again. Well, we don't know about the code genesis. Well, you know, you before you ship a product as a from a company, you conduct those types of reviews and you figure it all out. So,
right. Go ahead, Kat.
I was going to say, this is Sarah. I was going to say, I think Clark's exactly right that this is the type of thing that, you know, keeps lawyers up at night. But in many ways, these are kind of theoretical problems, you know, similar to, not that things don't happen, but they don't happen at a rate anywhere like you might imagine. Just the same as, you know, what happens if some employee goes rogue and does something or that sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah, so. The risks are really low, and the sort of the thing I was trying to articulate with some of these people that contribute to open source software projects or free software projects is that they really like to write code. That's what they do for a living. That's what they do for a hobby, right? They're not, most of them probably aren't all that interested in going and ripping something off from some proprietary solution and then dumping it into open source software project. They like to write code. That's what they do. They contribute it. And I think that's another reason why we don't have many of these cases.
Yeah. Right. And I'm... go ahead, Kat.
One other thing I think is that people, particularly, they like to write code and they don't want to sue. Particularly, they don't want to sue if they don't have to. They don't want to sue if something is being used not strictly in accordance with the license, but generally according to what they hoped would happen. You know, you see people mixing free software and open source licenses that aren't strictly compatible. In general, people are okay with that. They could technically sue for infringement, but they're not going to unless they feel that somebody has really treated them badly, taken advantage of the things that they tried to contribute.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
As a non-coder, I hesitate to throw this comment in, but it seems to me too like technology of all things is constantly evolving, and that the code that was written 3 years ago is not what you want to be adopting for your new project necessarily, that you need to constantly keep it moving forward. That's not to say you couldn't adopt something that someone had written more recently that might be useful, but it seems like the notion to constantly push ahead and progress would also factor into having code be as represented. Do you think that's the case, Clark?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it taps back into Kat's point that, right, unless you're just eager to sue someone and dump money into that, you know, there's plenty of cases of copyright infringement or where, like Kat's saying, the way you've used the code is not exactly compatible with the license that governs it. But unless you're just eager to sue, right, like you're saying, you move on. They're more interested in innovation and accelerating the pace of innovation. And so, right, you might have some outliers where people just resort to suing, but it's in the real world, it's a very low risk that companies spend a lot of time mitigating against.
Right. Another person who writes a lot about the open source world is Clark's brother, Matt. We have a couple of pieces in our discussion points today. He's also a lawyer, and he's the VP of mobile at Adobe. Clark, is that right?
I think so. He changes jobs every year or two, so I sort of lose track.
But
he's sort of a lawyer. He mm-hmm. went to law school, but he never practiced law. So I wouldn't hire him.
But he writes a lot.
Yeah. We won't tell him that you said that.
Yes. Ringing endorsement of Matt at AC. Anyway, he had an interesting piece on the whole what would happen if Microsoft open sourced Windows. Notion. And the thing that he hits upon there that I thought was really interesting is the whole move toward cloud computing has just moved lock-in off the device itself and put it in the cloud so that, you know, you're not really losing your customers or you know, Microsoft doesn't really have to sell Windows anymore necessarily if folks are locked into the Microsoft cloud the way that folks in the business side of things might be locked into Salesforce, for example. I thought that was an interesting insight. Clark, do you have anything to add to your brother's thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I think he does have a point, because if you're sort of the old model of peddling bits of software is sort of not the way you make money. To the extent that things move into the cloud, the Amazon model of selling a service rather than selling pieces of technology. I mean, you're utilizing the technology to make a buck, but you know, if you can get them locked into your cloud services, then who cares if you open source the software? I mean, it might help competitors start up and compete against you. But if you have people who really believe in your platform and are locked in to a certain extent, then the fact that someone has a competing platform might not harm you. And in fact, having someone else improve upon your platform, then you might be able to then take advantage of those same improvements, right? That's the whole sort of philosophy of free software, open source. So, you know, it becomes a lot less crucial to maintain control over the actual software in that case. And so, I think he has a good point here. Makes a lot of sense.
As you were talking, I was thinking about how kids today who play Minecraft are getting to see sort of a good example for them as they grow up of how what you were just talking about, adopt the way you can adopt improvements that others have made for you, because that's what Minecraft does. They allow people to make mods and things, and many of the mods get incorporated into the official release of the game. So they get to see this play out and see how that improves the world for everyone, except perhaps the modders who, you know, I'm not sure how that compensation all works. Kat, I was prompted to think as Clark was speaking there and we're discussing his brother's point about the cloud and lock-in in the cloud. I'm wondering, you know, what the state is of open source efforts in the cloud.
Well, it looks like more and more people are moving their services to the cloud, and I'm not necessarily sure that's a win, even if they are open source. The Free Software Foundation Europe has a slogan that on a laptop sticker, which I can't show you, but that there is no cloud, there's only other people's computers. So, people talk about the cloud as if it's this ethereal thing that exists, and you know, everything around it encourages you to think about it that way. But what is it? It's you're just kind of outsourcing what you do to some machine other people control, and maybe that works for you. But is it meaningful to have open source on a system that you don't have any access to? You only have can poke it and prod it in the ways that they tell you. Maybe it's convenient for you, but is that, you know, and it. Maybe it's good that it's open source, but it depends on why you're choosing it. Certainly, it doesn't give you a lot of the advantages of it, such as the ability to tweak it to your needs, or you know, the ability even to see what it's doing. You can interact with it. Maybe you can take it and fork it if they've used a license that allows that. But you know, how meaningful is it? Certainly, it might be a business strategy that makes sense, and maybe it's better than nothing at all. But I'm not sure that we could call it a win if that happened.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And there's this. Can I just jump in?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, there's this looming fear with stuff moving to the cloud as well, right? That the advantages of free and open source software development sort of disappear. I think this is part of what Kat might be getting at, is just that, you know, once it moves to the cloud, that's technically maybe not a distribution under the licenses, and so if a company, you know, takes but then doesn't give back because they say, well, you know, the software is not being distributed, we don't have to release the modifications under the GPL, for instance, I think this is the reason why, you know, Free Software Foundation, I think, is responsible for, you know, crafting the Affero general public license once upon a time that makes a hosting environment, a distribution that would trigger sort of the copyleft provisions of the license. Now, so that's one approach. Another approach is just that, you know, companies realize that sort of taking and then just sticking it in the cloud and saying it's not a distribution, so we don't have to release what we're doing, that they see that that's sort of a foolhardy effort, and that the lessons of the free and open source software movement of the past, you know, two decades or so should make clear that, you know, the better business, even a better business strategy, is to collaboratively innovate and sell other things that have value other than, you know, the software itself. So,
all right. Well, I think you've just given us our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these passphrases in for people who are listening to the show for continuing legal or other professional education credit. And our first phrase for this show is going to be collaborative innovation. We'll put another one in at some point further on. If you'd like more information about asking for credit for listening to or watching the show, head on over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv. Find our show page there. And there's a nice guide to the various jurisdictions in the United States for lawyers who need to get those MCLE credit hours in. Clark, you have written a lot over the years about the interrelationship between copyright and technology. We've been talking about the free software licenses, the open source licenses that are available out there, like Creative Commons. They're sort of a roundabout effort at end running copyright law, making norms in society work a little differently than copyright law on the books would have them work. Someone might be tempted to say that copyright law and technology are at loggerheads because people have to do that kind of thing. But one of your articles talks about how copyright and technology are interdependent on each other. Could you explain that for us?
Yeah, so that article, I mean, the basic concept is just that, you know, technological innovation spurs creativity and therefore copyrightable content, and copyrightable content spurs technological innovation. And so, you know, there's definitely, there are loggerheads, and there's a lot of inefficiencies, and there's a lot of cases, I think, where copyright gets in the way of technological innovation, but it also spurs it. I mean, I'm just thinking of my former company, Amazon, right? There's increasingly more types of content available. And so what do? They create, you know, technological innovations to take advantage of so one, make that content more available to a variety of people, and two, you know, try to make a business out of it. And Netflix is another example, right, where they've engaged in extensive technological innovation to make copyrightable content available in a way that, you know, a lot of people like. And without copyright, protecting that content, it's not as viable of a business model, just because, right, Netflix could create these technological innovations in order to make the content available, but copyright acts as a, right, it gives them an economic incentive to do so. You know, so that's sort of the basic relationship I describe in the paper you're referring to. That said, you know, it's not a perfect relationship by any means, right? Content owners as well as technological innovators such as Apple, Amazon, another, Google, right? They have incentives to restrict your access to content in ways that perhaps, you know, because of their economic incentives that might contravene the purposes of copyright, some of the exceptions to copyright, such as fair use. Then you've got the DMCA, which you've talked a lot about recently on this show, that sort of adds fuel to that fire. So, again, the point of that paper was just to say these two, technological innovation and copyright, there's not a perfect relationship, but they do have a relationship that provides us a number of benefits. Those can be improved upon. They should be, but it's all not. It's not all doom and gloom, I guess.
That's good to know. I hate it when it's all doom and gloom. Before we move on and start talking more about the DMCA, which we have been talking about lately, I wanted to just ask, because it's not something that maybe is something everyone could answer, although everyone uses Wikipedia. And with Kat here, I thought I'd just have you explain for a moment, if you could, about the reusability, what sort of licensing applies to everything that people find on Wikimedia Foundation properties?
So, everything on the Wikimedia sites, the Wikipedia Encyclopedia and the media repositories, the other projects, is under a Creative Commons license. Wikipedia is under the Creative Commons by SA license, by share alike. What's interesting about that is that Wikimedia Foundation has no more rights to it than any end user. It just uses it under the terms of the CC license, the same as anyone else. And that was a deliberate choice when the licensing for the project was decided. Wikimedia didn't want to be in a privileged position, didn't want to be able to take anything it couldn't redistribute under the same terms.
So when you post to Wikipedia, as you're pushing post somewhere, are you agreeing to a Creative Commons license to what you're uploading?
You are. When you submit your edit, there's a little notice under the box that says you agree to this license. If you're submitting photos or videos or other things, you have a little bit of a wider choice of license, but it still has to be something that you can redistribute, you can remix, and that also can be used commercially. Which is unusual. A lot of people don't realize that, but there are so many commercial projects that are not strictly nonprofit, but that make really good use of the material that that the Wikimedia didn't want to restrict that. So that's explicitly permitted. And that surprises people. It's a big shift. It's also encouraged a lot of people to release content freely that they wouldn't have before, just because they want the exposure then, or just the satisfaction of contributing to Wikipedia.
Yeah, that's good to know. I think that's something that not everyone listening might have been aware of. All right, let's move on to, we have talked in recent episodes, I think maybe one or two back, about John Deere and its back and forth with the Copyright Office over whether there will be an exemption that would allow people to break copy protection in order to work on specifically for John Deere. There are John Deere devices, tractors and things. Obviously, there's been some backlash against John Deere by owners of tractors and people who follow copyright law. John Deere, on April 30th, wrote a letter to its dealers to help the dealers deal with these kinds of questions and answer some of the questions. This letter, I first saw it just this week, so I don't know if it just now leaked out, but Mike Godwin posted a copy to Twitter, and that's where I saw it. And it basically tries to explain to them, it wraps, as we have discussed on the show, John Deere's justification for needing copy protection for its systems in a safety rhetoric, you know, so that we're really, it doesn't really say anything about we need to lock up the code in your tractor because we're afraid that if the code got out there, it would be redistributed and used in other tractors and we would not benefit from our copyright. But they really couch it in a rhetoric of we need it to be safe and reliable for you and your customers. And so I guess there's nothing too surprising about that. What is surprising is how straightforward they're being, that really it's not so much a copyright holder interest that's being protected under the DMCA here. Sarah, did you see this letter and did you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I did see it. I thought it was really interesting to read. And in a lot of ways, I think some of what the letter says is easy to make fun of, which I think Boing Boing was doing a little bit, which I appreciated. But on the other hand, I think a lot of what they're saying was true under copyright. They were trying to explain the difference between owning a copyright in something and owning a physical thing. And it just shows how kind of counterintuitive that notion is. But I also think they were being a bit disingenuous about how that notion really applied to the situation at hand, because, you know, what the farmers, or I don't know who actually brought the petition to the copyright office, but the idea was for them to actually, you know, diagnose and fix their own tractors. There wasn't any sort of, I don't think there was any proposal about being able to share that copyrighted code beyond, beyond the person that was trying to fix it. So it was in some ways disingenuous, but I thought it was interesting that reading the letter, a lot of the copyright notions there were actually accurate. It just points out kind of how silly this notion is and how confusing it is, and how more and more we aren't owning what we think we own. Harkens back to what we talked about a few weeks ago when Aaron Perzanowski was on about, how everything is under a license now and how it's kind of changing this whole notion of ownership in very negative ways for consumers, I think.
Yeah. What do you think, Clark? Is open source the answer to this? Someone needs to make a tractor that they're not locking up under the DMCA?
Maybe, or you just, like a lot of people have wanted for a long time, get rid of some of those increasingly outdated provisions of the DMCA that, DMCA was 1998, we're in 2015, different world, different technological environment. I don't think the farmers or whoever want to tinker with this stuff, with the software, are amateurs. And if they they just do it wrong, you probably won't have any liability anyway if you waive warranties and so forth upon someone messing with it. So, I think we have other laws and regulations in place and contractual provisions that deal with the concerns that they outline in this letter. But they're sort of using copyright as a way to sort of protect other interests. And I'm not sure exactly what those interests are. I can guess at some of them, but I think this is a broader trend where copyright is being put to uses that aren't real, that copyright wasn't really intended for. You have all these unintended consequences, and I think this is just another example of that.
Right. On the safety front, there's certainly a lot to be said for you don't necessarily, when you're talking, there's all kinds of good reasons why you want people to be able to tinker around with software that's not hurtling down the road or on a railroad track at high speeds. We had just this last week the example of the train in Pennsylvania that took a turn at twice the speed that it should have. And then we had the NTSB representative, whose name is escaping me right now, who took to the talk show circuit in the wake of it and was making comments along the lines of, we do have technological measures that can limit the speed of trains, and it wasn't in effect on this stretch of track, with the implication being, another thing we talk about a lot here is the desirability of automated transport, that automation may have been able to prevent this crash. So I guess, not to too much jump into playing the devil's advocate role on behalf of John Deere here, but when you are talking about transportation devices, I think there are all kinds of good reasons why you want to be able to ensure the safety and reliability of the device. And there are probably all kinds of laws under which you can do it. I just don't know that the DMCA is where I want the copyright office and automakers and tractor manufacturers hanging their legal justification, because that has a lot of wide-ranging implications. Are you with me on that, Kat?
I am. I think that copyright is the wrong way to ensure the safety. And, you know, this problem is not unique to tractors, as shocking as that is. We see it in, you know, we've started seeing it even particularly with cars. People are fighting for the right to repair, just to be able to edit the software on their cars. That's clearly really life critical. Even with machines that are not transportation, we see it. Most cryptographic software, for example, people don't trust cryptographic software that isn't open source, where people can't audit it themselves. And that's, you know, that is partially like why people trust it, because everyone who can possibly try to break it can look at it, can audit it. You know, not always perfect, but certainly better than something that where nobody can see what it is. And when we have these things like tractors, like cars, where the manufacturers are basically just asking, trust us, right? We've seen this actually. I think there was a case with Toyota several years ago where there was, in fact, a software bug and nobody could see what it was. And it took a team of NASA auditors to basically look at this with the same standards that they would use to audit the space shuttle software and say, like, no, we would never have let this through. But certainly some of their customers could have done that, but they just weren't permitted to.
I just want to piggyback on that. I think, you know, what Kat is saying is exactly right, right? Like, John Deere, you know, they point to these safety interests, and I think that's sort of a relatively easy to understand thing to point to. But like Kat points out, right, like we don't know if the software that they've put in there is actually any good, right? Mm-hmm. Without someone getting in there and tinkering with it. And the people that are going to be tinkering with it are people who know what they're doing, right? These aren't amateurs. These aren't people who just just are doing it for the fun of it. They're most likely people that are going to be able to identify the types of vulnerabilities that Kat is mentioning in the Toyota example. And we've seen plenty of examples, I mean, with Toyota in particular over the years, where you've got all these bugs and defects that are actually causing people to die. And I think, yeah, maybe an open source model would help address a lot of those problems before they actually occur in real life. So,
all right. Well, I think we've just gotten our second MCLE passphrase for the show, and that's going to be freedom to tinker. Something I think we'll come back to later on in the show and expand on even more. But right now, let's turn to an interesting copyright case, an interesting fair use case called Katz versus Shevoldina, where a district court has found fair use. That's now on appeal to the 11th Circuit. And once again, the reason it jibes well with what we've been discussing is sort of a hidden agenda using copyright law, not necessarily to protect one's copyright interests. And here the interest in play is really the interest in non-distribution of the material. I think, Sarah, did you put this in our discussion points for the week? Maybe I'll let you tee this one up.
Yeah, I think I did. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a fascinating piece. So it's about this case where some real estate developer had this horrible photo of himself that he didn't want people using. So he had the copyright and the image assigned to him and then sued for infringement. The really interesting thing about it was that the paper argued fair use in part because of the market value factor in fair use. So there are four factors, and the fourth is the effect on the market for the original work. And the argument that the paper made, which is really brilliant, is that there is no market. He's actually trying to eliminate, you know, any usage of it. So it's impossible for there to be any effect on the value because he doesn't plan to monetize it. So I thought that was kind of an interesting argument and made sense. Also, just as a practical matter, I mean, this is the Streisand effect, right? Like, I we would have never seen this image. Now we're seeing it. I'm sure there are more, you know, he's increased the demand for this photo. But I'm also sympathetic. I mean, there are hundreds of horrible photos of me out there, and I can imagine wanting that to them taken down. It's just that this is an example of trying to use copyright for purposes for which it was not created, which I think is almost always a bad thing, even if you're sympathetic to this situation. So,
right. I think it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out. It's on appeal to the 11th Circuit now. The EFF and others have weighed in with amicus briefs. So we'll wait for the 11th to see if they agree that this was fair use. It seemed like a lot of the district court's decision on this had to do with the fact that the market for the work wasn't in play here, because as far as the rights holder is concerned, there shouldn't be a market for this work. They want to completely control the work and not give it a market whatsoever. But scarcity creates a market too. I mean, that doesn't necessarily rule out the notion of making a marketplace argument. If he wanted to sell this photo, maybe the fact that it's been locked up or not authorized would increase its market value. I don't know if that makes any sense for the court to pick up on or not, but we'll see how the briefing and then the opinion goes. Kat, do you have any thoughts on this?
My first thought was the same as Sarah's, that the Streisand effect. You, if you didn't want anybody to see this photo, similarly, yes. It really depends on the fair use argument for it. And I think I agree with that point that scarcity could create a market, and like maybe you're using scarcity strategically to create the market for it. But that doesn't appear what was happening in this case. It looks like, you know, he was a newsworthy person in a story where they wanted to show him as this kind of ridiculous figure. And they succeeded, right? And they couldn't have used other photos to do that.
Yes. Excellent rule of thumb. If you don't want something publicly available, don't file a lawsuit over it. Clark, any final thoughts on this?
No, I largely agree. I mean, I think he went and had the copyright in the thing assigned to him after the fact.
Yes.
Just so that he could, you know, protect, basically suppress the photo. Didn't want it out there, so... You know, it's not that unflattering when I look at it.
It's like, yes, all of us have photos like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, there are photos like that of all of us being generated right now as we do the show. People are doing screen caps as we, yeah, so just know that. Clark, let's talk about ebooks for a bit, since you worked at Amazon in Lab 126. Tell us what Lab 126 was or is.
Yeah, it's Amazon's research and development affiliate or subsidiary. So they do all the consumer electronic products that Amazon does are sort of developed and brainstormed down there. So I was there supporting hardware, software teams, emerging technologies teams, and so it, you know, when I started there in, I don't remember the year, but it just grew and grew, and I assume is still growing. A lot of interesting things going on there.
Right. So you worked on the Kindle and the Kindle Fire and the Kindle Fire HD, and I'm assuming other products for the company as well. But all of those are you know, the flagship ebook products for Amazon, and Amazon arguably has the biggest ebook business, maybe demonstrably has, I'm just not sure. Yeah. So I'm just wondering, you know, we've been talking about open source through the years. It's interesting to look at how ebooks have developed over the years too, their adoption and popularity. And now apparently their waning popularity just a bit. Paper book sales are actually up by 2.4% in the last year. What do you think is going on here?
You know, I don't know. I saw that and I was a little bit surprised, just based on personal experiences where I used to buy, when I worked at Amazon, I used to buy paperbacks. Now that I don't anymore. And so I don't know if that's an actual trend or if it's just a little blip, right, along the way. But it could, you know, it could be, it could be occurring for some of the reasons that we've talked about with respect to John Deere and other topics where people just don't like, right, buying something and then not feeling like they can control it. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and some of these others have implemented limited lending features for the books or transferability, but it's really limited. And so if I buy a book and I want to share it, I'm done with it. I don't want it anymore. And I want my, you know, my mom to read it. She's got to, in most cases, go and buy her own copy. And you know, when I die, what happens to my digital assets? What happens to my account, right? Is it are they transferable or not? So there's just a lot of questions that people maybe, you know, maybe people are starting to think about these things. I don't think the average person thinks a great deal about some of the technical legal issues relating to these digital assets, but that might be playing a role in some of the press that has and cases that have made it into mainstream media about what content owners, the restrictions they impose on these different types of content. And so people, you know, one response is just to vote with your feet and say, well, I'm just going to go buy a book. I know I can give that away. And sell it. Now, one thing that's interesting, though, back to our sort of discussion about imposing terms and sort of using software as a proxy for controlling a physical item. I mean, I've had people reach out to me and say, I sold a book on eBay, a physical book on eBay, and within a day, I got notification from, you know, different groups saying, you're not allowed to sell that, right? Look inside the book. There are use restrictions. And so it's not only always digital assets where this type of behavior is being manifested. Companies are starting to try to do similar things with physical books as well. So that's another interesting twist, I think, to this whole issue.
Yeah. I haven't found a book yet that had a don't sell this book clause, but that would be an interesting one to test in court. A physical book, obviously. All right. Titus in IRC wants to know where all the Easter eggs are in the Kindle, Clark. if you can share them with us.
I'm bound by confidentiality requirements in perpetuity.
That's
but
right.
any Easter eggs in there, any problems with any of those devices are not my fault. When I was there, everything was perfect.
Of course. How could it not be? Yeah. I'm probably not the best person to try and decide why ebooks aren't working very well because they just never really took well for me. I mean, I have several of them and I've read them on both an iPad and a Kindle. And but I'm much more an audiobook person these days. I really have gotten hooked on the great narrators that are available. And but still, the problem of having the work locked up and not shareable exists in the audiobook world, at least the Audible world. You're not supposed to share those files around. You can obviously get freely licensed audiobooks, but they're not as easy to find. Do you have any thoughts, Sarah, on printed books versus ebooks and whether it's the restricted use that might be making ebooks look less attractive?
I don't know. I mean, I think that that's fascinating. I know for me, mm-hmm. I'm kind of the same way as you, Denise. And I buy book. Well, actually, I don't do the audiobook thing, but I tried mm-hmm. ebooks and I actually found them to be less convenient because my battery would die or, you know, I'd run out of power on my iPad or, you know, I'd forget to take it with me. I don't know. It just, or I want to highlight, like I've been buying books like once a week lately by through Amazon, but physical books mm-hmm. and just find that so much more convenient. And in part it is because I don't have to worry about, you know, when I'm done, I could do whatever I want with it. And I can take notes on it and I can have that with me wherever I go. I don't know. It just, to me, it seems more convenient and it's in part related to this whole issue of control over what you buy.
Right. I'm glad you pointed out you buy your book, your physical books from Amazon. IRC has been reminding me. You know, they still sell those things and CDs too. Yes, yes, they do. Kat, any thoughts on this?
Sure. So I'm mostly a paper book for pleasure person also, but for reference books, I really like to have something I can copy and paste from and take notes on. You know, I'm really on the side of you should be able to actually own the things that you have and not have them taken away from you, not have people also be able to keep tabs on what you're reading. One thing that happens with ebooks, especially if you can't see what software people are using to manage your ebooks. Mm-hmm. And so back in my history, I worked in tech policy for the American Library Association, and the libraries really want to use ebooks for their patrons. And every segment of society uses the public libraries, and the ebook solutions aren't working for all of them. Some don't have computers that can handle it. Some people are blind or print disabled and need to be able to change the settings on their book or have it read in text to speech. And the ebook solutions are causing problems for all of them, right? People can't use them. The librarians hate them. They're getting locked into these contracts with them that they get locked into for years, and then they can't change them. So it's creating problems for more than just the individual user who wants to make sure that their books aren't taken away from them. So I really like the initiatives that some of the publishers have done where they're offering DRM-free ebooks. I think those are great, but otherwise I just won't buy the ones that have DRM. That just creates so many problems.
Right. And the whole having others know what you read and when you're reading it and all about your habits is a nice segue into a privacy discussion, which we're going to have in just a moment here, right after we thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Blue Apron. One of my favorite things and one of the things that has made life in recent months much nicer around the Howell household. I'm sure all of us enjoying the Blue Apron meals understand that, because they really do add a great dimension to the cuisine that you're offering up at home. It's much more like a restaurant experience at home when you're making Blue Apron food. It's definitely a fun cooking experience. It takes all the inconvenience of shopping out of the equation for you, because they send you what you need in exactly the proportions that you need it in. All of the things that you want to have happen with the food you're preparing at home happens with Blue Apron. You want it to be a good value. You want it to be quick to prepare. You want it to be fun to prepare. You want it to be healthy and delicious, not super laden with things that you need to worry about your family eating, or really laden with problematic things at all. You know, when you're making Blue Apron, that the ingredients are fresh, you're cutting them up, you're seeing that yourself. Blue Apron makes cooking delicious meals easy and fun by delivering those fresh ingredients right to you. The meals are ready to cook. They come to your home, where you don't have to go out and forage for all the ingredients. You don't have to forage through your cookbook collection to decide what to make, because a whole team of very talented people at Blue Apron are putting together these meals. And they're putting them together, this is one of the things I love the most about it, with ingredients that you might not pick out yourself at the grocery store. Certainly my mother and I were discussing this, because she also is a huge Blue Apron fan now. And she's the person I learned how to cook from, along with my dad. And she's hugely on board. And she was telling me in one of her recent meals, rhubarb was involved. When was the last time you put rhubarb on your shopping list to pick up down at the store? Just doesn't happen in my world. But to have Blue Apron send it to you and incorporate it really nicely into a recipe makes you try these new flavors and ingredients, or maybe things you've tried before but don't usually make their way into your cooking. The meals are less than $10 a piece. They send you all the things that you need, perfectly proportioned, step-by-step recipe instructions with beautifully printed pictures, so you know what it's supposed to look like. If you're, you know, getting too far afield, you can make some adjustments. And the actual prep is very easy and fun. Much as I love hanging out in the grocery store. It's really more of a luxury for me to be able to do that. It's not something that I can do day in and day out. Time is just too short for that. So Blue Apron takes that piece out of the equation. It's perfect for date night, cooking with friends. They even offer family plans with kid-friendly ingredients so the whole family can eat well and have fun preparing the meals together. Each balanced meal you're going to find has about 500 to 700 calories per serving. They're so delicious, you'd never know that. Cooking takes half an hour, shipping is free, and the menus are always new. They won't send you the same meal twice. That doesn't mean you can't make the same thing twice. I have plenty of these recipe cards I'm hanging on to because they not only list all of the prep steps in very easy, repeatable form, but they have all of the amounts and items that you need to recreate that meal. So when you do have time to go to the grocery store, they work around your schedule and dietary preferences, and Blue Apron's experts source only the best seasonal ingredients for incredible meals like hearty chicken salad and white pizza. You'll cook these incredible meals and be blown away by the quality and freshness. Blue Apron, it's a better way to cook. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's right, two free meals just for going to blueapron.com/twit. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, so we've had some big developments on the privacy front recently. Let's talk about them. So we've talked about the ACLU versus Clapper case before on the show. The Second Circuit has gotten its hands on the case and decided that the NSA surveillance being challenged there was actually illegal, that it exceeded the scope that was permitted under the Patriot Act. Clark, I know you've been paying attention to this. You want to discuss the Clapper case a bit for us?
Sure. So, you know, there was I think some hope in some circles the court would reach the constitutional dimensions of the NSA surveillance program. So mm-hmm. Fourth Amendment, First Amendment implications. They talk about both of those bases in the case and suggest that there's, you know, concerns there. But like you say, they ruled that Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act did not authorize the surveillance program. It's just, you know, the way that the Fisk court interpreted relevance to then allow the government to just en masse collect bulk data about every phone call in the United States. It was just that they said it was impossible to square that program with Section 215 and the actual language. So. You know, I think some people feel like this is sort of Orrin Kerr over the Washington Post suggested this is a symbolic victory because U.S. Patriot Act is sunsetting in a couple weeks, and the House and the Senate are debating bills to sort of replace the program. I think it does have some relevance, though, because the Second Circuit has provided some guidance on the confined nature or definition of the word relevance. And so whatever does come out of Congress to replace Section 215 would do well to take into consideration the court ruling in crafting a language. It may be too late because the compromise has already been hammered out, and so we may just get whatever the House and the Senate have come to at this point. But in future cases, it still may have some relevance in terms of whether the new statute has problems of its own in terms of what it authorizes.
Yeah, I think that will be helpful for lawmakers to know going forward what is going to replace the Patriot Act and be able to hold up in court. Sarah, any thoughts on this Second Circuit decision?
Yeah, the other thing I was going to mention that I think is important from the case is that they found that the ACLU had standing, which I think was an important piece of it, so that just the mere collection of data warranted both Fourth Amendment standing and First Amendment standing because of the potential chilling effect on speech. So I think that's another reason that this is actually, you know, an important victory for privacy advocates.
Right. A large number of these cases challenging government surveillance have been tossed in the past because of a lack of standing. So this is a good development for folks who want to continue bringing these challenges. Kat, any thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with what Clark and Sarah had said. Another thing, I think it's good to have these victories for the just for public shaping public opinion about it, for people to see that, like, yes, there have been these cases, and yes, there has been they've found that there's been overreach. It'll just shape the political debate. People will have to talk about this. People will have to talk about the value and the compromises of these programs.
It's an important point.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of attention has been being paid to what the government is up to and how they're monitoring all of the various data. You know, I mean, this is the phone company and phone conversations are just one aspect of all of this, right? It goes back to what Kat was talking about before, that there's so much data about us that we entrust to the companies that are helping us lead our lives. And all of that data is theoretically and sometimes in a very concrete, non-theoretical manner available to government investigators when they are trying to fight crime. So it's definitely something that's near and dear to the public's heart these days. And we're going to talk in a moment about what Congress has been doing in response to that. Before we get there, I wanted to talk briefly, kind of from one heavy privacy story to a somewhat lighter one. I think we've talked before about the Lilly camera. It was at first touted before it was made available for sale. You can order pre-order these things now. They're going to ship next February. The Lilly camera is, here we go. Some video is going to be helpful to explain what it is. You carry a little sensor on you that is tagged to the camera, and the camera is on a little flying rotocopter, quadcopter drone that follows you based on the sensor. And then it just nicely puts itself down when you're done with it, and it follows you around and you know, records these wonderful extreme or not so extreme moments in your life where, you know, it's the ultimate selfie cam. It doesn't even need a stick, right? So I can definitely see people enjoying this in their leisure activities. But my immediate reaction when I saw this thing is, yeah, I want one, and I don't want anyone around me to have one. Because they're, you know, when we initially talked about it on the show, we talked about its potential as a stalker cam, and the company in its FAQ has addressed that a bit and said, "Come on, you know, the thing makes noise. It only takes good video when it's within, I think, 100 feet of you, and optimally, it wants to be about 10 or 20 or 30 feet away from you to really get the video. So you're going to know if someone planted the little tracker device on you. You're going to see this thing following you pretty easily. But I just wanted to toss it out to people, see what you guys think about the Lilly Cam, see if you, like me, hope that they don't become too widespread. The very first thing you saw in that video that Victor just played for us was someone either skiing or snowboarding. And I know when I'm on a mountain, if there are 40 of those things flying around tracking people down the hill, I'm going to smack right into one. I just don't have the Lilly avoidance capabilities that I think you really would need. So yeah, the guy's snowboarding. So what do you think of this, Sarah, the Lilly Cam? What does it mean for our future?
Oh gosh, I don't know the answer to that. I do kind of want one, I have to say. The video sold me.
Yeah.
It's funny. I showed it to my husband and he immediately thought, oh, we should get one and put the tracking device on our dog. And then if she loves to chase the ball, that'd be kind of fun.
Yeah.
But he also mentioned the skiing thing. We're not skiers, but he said, what if everyone started having those at ski slopes? It would be just a nightmare, I imagine, with, you know, logistics.
It would. I'm sure that ski slopes will have to have some sort of restriction on cameras following you down the hill because...
Yeah, they will have to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But as far as what it's going to mean in the world, I don't know. I think we're going to have more and more of these things. They're going to be cameras everywhere. We have to figure out some privacy laws to deal with this sort of thing. Even where this one, their FAQ at least makes it seem like it's true that you couldn't very easily use this to track other people. But I don't know for sure if that's true. And there's going to be, you know, and there probably already are tons of drones that you could easily use to track other people. So it's not just Lily. And I think that our privacy laws are not equipped to handle this challenge at this point.
Yeah, let me read a couple of salient points from the FAQ here. The first one we've been talking about, can I use Lily to spy on my neighbors? Lily is always pointing at you, they say, and less than 100 feet from you. Pro tip, best shots are from 10 to 30 feet. Also, Lily's motors make noise, so other people will most likely notice Lily and quickly figure out where you are. You are better off climbing up a tree and using binoculars. And then as far as our ski slope question, let's see what I just saw here. Usage. I better search for it. There's a lot here. One second. Oh, yeah. this does not bode well. Does Lily have obstacle avoidance? Currently, Lily does not have any obstacle avoidance capabilities. We have found that most outdoor activities do not need obstacle avoidance because Lily can follow the user's path. But again, there are no guarantees that Lily will not hit anything while it is following you. So Lily's not going to try not to hit me, and I know I'm not going to be able to avoid it. Clark, you're in Utah. You are an hour away from ski slopes where these things might be, maybe not next ski season, but the ski season after that, all over the place. Yeah. What do you think about Lily?
You know, I think something that Sarah pointed to or sort of implied in one of her comments is that, you know, their FAQ addresses a lot of the concerns that people would have, but this technology is only going to get better, right? And these concerns are just going to crop up again and again and again. I do think we need a new term for narcissism because I think it's not adequately capturing sort of the direction of technology these days. But, you know, I think it taps into a broader concern of do we let, right, in terms of privacy, do we let the technology sort of dictate what are reasonable expectations of privacy, or do we sort of push back against the technology and say, no, you know, even though technology can capture this type of information about any given person, we as a society decide that's too much, right? Because if you know, there's a lot of people in terms of advocates of unfettered technological innovation, they think the privacy is going to get in the way of a lot of cool things. And it could, right? That could be a result. But we as a society have to determine, and like Sarah says, determine what we think our privacy interests are and where we want those boundaries to be. And the current sort of legal regime definitely doesn't address what's coming in terms of technology and its implications for privacy. It doesn't address it right now, right? But mm-hmm. It certainly won't address what's coming.
Yep. I think we will continue to see the lawmakers and society struggle with technologies that make us all rethink what is privacy and what is narcissism. If we move right on to our legislation and policy section of the show, I can tell you more about Freedom to Tinker and a good development there. This is very exciting for folks who have followed the kind of law that we talk about here on the show and have been rattling around the web, reading the writings of people who have been analyzing and really crucial in the development and education about these laws. And Ed Felton is one of them. Freedom to Tinker has been his blog where he has written for many, many years. He's a professor at Princeton. And right now he's been appointed by the White House to join the Office of Science and Technology Policy as the Deputy U.S. Chief Technology Officer. So this is very exciting. Good to see good people go to influential and hopefully change in a good way, inducing kinds of positions. I didn't say that very well, but you know what I'm trying to say. Kat, what do you think about Ed Felton taking on this role?
I think it's really great to see. It's really great to see particularly them appointing somebody who has actually worked hands-on as a technologist appointed into a policy role. That's something that a lot of people have felt have been missing in the technology discussions in the White House for a long time.
Yeah, he's not a law professor. He's a computer science professor, so he knows his tech. As a law professor, Clark, are you also happy about this?
Yeah, I think so. By all accounts, he's just a brilliant guy, and like Kat says, is sort of involved with the technology and sort of the implications of the technology in a way that will really equip him well to sort of advise. It's not, you know, we all know how politics go, and his views probably won't just translate into official policy, but they should have a significant effect, and I think that seems like it will be a good thing.
Right. He's also taught public affairs, so he's certainly no stranger to the policy arena. And in 2010, he was named the chief technologist for the FTC, which he assumed in 2011. So, Sarah, any further thoughts?
No, I don't know much about him. Certainly everything sounds positive, and a lot of people whose opinions I really respect are excited about it. So I am too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's a good guy. All right, let's talk about Congress trying its hand at reining in NSA surveillance. The USA Freedom Act passed, and not without a good deal of controversy. Its goal seems to be curbing NSA spying, but folks aren't real pleased with all the permutations of the act. Clark, what are some of the things that they're not pleased about?
Well, I think the issue I mentioned earlier about some of the definitions of terms, relevance, and so forth. I mean, there's still a lot of ambiguity in the bill as it's been passed. People are hoping the Senate sort of introduces some tighter definitions on terms such as relevance, suppression of data that isn't relevant to what mm-hmm. you are actually investigating. So there seem to be, as with any, probably any bill, there seem to be significant loopholes that still allow for sort of monitoring and surveillance that has triggered a lot of the public backlash in the first place.
Right. Kat, better than nothing, or should they try again?
Do I have to pick one or the other? I think
you can pick a third. What's behind door number three? I'm not sure what to ask.
better than nothing, but also I don't know. I think they should try again. One thing mm-hmm. I am also worried, like everyone else, is about the vagueness of the terms, particularly where we've seen before where there's any room for interpretation that they'll take the most expansive reading as possible. So I would really would like to have seen more strict definitions.
Yes. Well, there has been a good deal of analysis and poking holes in the law. So, Sarah, do you think that will have an impact?
I don't know. I thought it was interesting that EFF had supported the legislation until the Clapper case was decided, in which case they decided that they needed to revise the legislation to make the relevance requirement more strict and in line with the court's opinion. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I did notice too that CDT though is supporting the legislation. So it's always kind of interesting to see, you know, with these people that are poring over the legislation, how they come out. Cause obviously I haven't read the full bill by any means, but.
Mm-hmm.
No one has.
No one has. Somebody
well,
has.
Let's hope CDT and EFF have for sure, because we need those guys in there deciding if it's good or bad or indifferent. All right. I think speaking of good, bad, and indifferent, it seems like we have a movement on certain sites that have not been known necessarily for reining in bad activity, a movement toward reining it in and in somewhat creative ways and doing it through changes in their terms of service. I think we are the only people who could make terms of service seem dramatic because that bumper just did so. All right. So I'm referring to Twitter, which came out with some really interesting changes a while back, but we haven't talked about them on the show yet, to the way it's going to handle people acting badly on Twitter. Posting abusive tweets and threatening tweets. And it's a really, I want to ask you guys if you think that this looks good on paper, but really isn't going to make a difference, because I can see how someone confronted with these penalties that Twitter is now going to impose might be able to skirt them. But it certainly does look good on paper. And one of the things that Twitter is going to do is if someone has run afoul of its abuse policies, it's going to put the onus back on them. First of all, it's going to lock up their account. And then in order to unlock the account and be able to post to that account again, the person is going to have to go in and delete the abusive tweets themselves. You're cleaning up your own mess kind of thing. There's a lot more to this policy, but I did think that that had sort of a justice kind of component to it, rough justice, non-court imposed justice component to it. Of course, it's not that hard to fire up a Twitter account. If you're not that invested in your account, you don't care if you lose, all the customization that you've added to all your followers, everyone you're following, you're willing to recreate that. You could just sort of thumb your nose at Twitter and its deletion requirements and start a new account. So that's why I wonder, how effective you think this is. What do you think, Clark?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think if people want to get around it, they can. I think these types of changes sort of, for me, make me think of just sort of the broader implications of where most public speech and debate and discourse occurs, or increasingly more of it, which is on sites like Twitter, Reddit, Facebook, wherever. And if we, how we feel about a corporation sort of controlling the marketplace of ideas in this way. And, while these changes in most cases will probably actually lead to some good in terms of shutting down people who are engaging in this type of behavior, you can imagine that sometimes, it's not going to be a perfect sort of process, and they might start restricting types of speech that they deem abusive, but in terms of First Amendment values, we would prefer to have on there. I mean, not personally prefer to have on there, but just in terms of supporting the First Amendment in general. But, because Twitter is sort of this private or public corporation, but a corporation, not the government, we just have a different analysis and things that they are and aren't able to do. So that it raises that concern for me generally, even if in 99% of the cases I think, yeah, that guy should be off Twitter. That person should just,
They do have this mobile phone number verification requirement that is necessary to get your account back too. So I'm wondering if that, how much of that data they're keeping track of. It's not as easy to change your mobile phone number, I suppose, as it is to just attach another email address to a new Twitter account. Kat, this is all sort of related to what we've been talking about, keeping tabs on people's behavior and the data that Twitter has on them, which would include whether they've had their account locked out like this. Do you think it's a good step?
So yes and no. I think it's good that Twitter has to, when you're posting to Twitter, it's not a public space. You're using resources that are Twitter's. They're choosing how to run their company. It's good of them to make it explicit. Like, this is the service we're running. These are the rules that we're choosing for it. Rather than pretending to be hands-off, except sometimes when they intervene and not being explicit about it. I think being explicit about it, like, this is the community we're running. These are the rules we're imposing. You violate these rules. For the benefit of the community as we see it, it makes it a little better, kind of establishing that, yes, we do have standards for behavior, and these are what they are. The mobile phone verification, I think, is actually kind of problematic, particularly because Twitter's been used so much as an outlet for activist movements, for people who don't want to compromise their identities. We've seen it a lot in places where people think it's really the only way they have to speak. They may not have a number that they can give out or that they feel safe giving out or that isn't going to be tracked. So it would be good if there were some better way for people to verify or to get around that. To get around that, not just for people identified as those groups, but really for anybody who has something that they want to keep private. But for them to say, like, we are not just hands off, like, we have rules and these are what we're enforcing. I think that's a good thing. I share Clark's concerns about the fact that we're all speaking through intermediaries now, that they're really, unless you're running your own server somewhere and you're running your own network that maybe even your friends don't know how to connect to. There are certain things you can't say. That is really troublesome. But is there a way, like, how can we enable freedom of speech without making it just a terrible place for everyone else where they are subjected to threats and to violence and to other things? That's a much harder problem, and I'm not going to propose a solution.
Right. So Reddit, too, has announced that just on Thursday, it's updating its site-wide policies to now finally explicitly prohibit harassment. And it's hoping that that will promote free expression and that it will, reduce the trolling and harassment that was otherwise not specifically frowned upon by Reddit. Reddit's still not going to do anything to actively police the site. However, it's going to rely on users to do that and turn people in if they're violating the guidelines. Sarah, any thoughts on Twitter or Reddit?
I agree with Clark and Kat. I think generally these things are good to have. It's community management policies. I actually think that online harassment is a serious problem and a scary thing, and that needs to be dealt with. I think the danger, though, is when we don't know what those rules are. And so the more transparent that platforms can be about what their policies are and what the definitions are of what falls under what category, the better, because then we actually know what it is that we're dealing with. And I think there are certainly going to be edge cases that are going to be run into speech concerns, but there are also going to be plenty of, very black and white cases where it's a good thing that that, for example, I think Twitter has a new filter that's going to reduce visibility of abusive tweets. You can imagine that will be a good thing in maybe 99% of the cases, and then there will be some edge cases where maybe things aren't working like we want them to. But as long as we know what those rules are, I think that really goes a long way toward kind of helping ensure trust and ensure that the speech concerns aren't problematic. I guess, Kat, one thing I wanted to ask you is, how does Wikimedia handle these? They must have community policies about harassment and bullying and that sort of thing. How do they kind of manage that? Do you know?
So actually, really similarly to the way that Reddit is proposing to handle it, it's all community-based. There are terms of service that state that basically no illegal actions, you know, no abusing other users. But what that means is really often left up to the community. And there is this whole, by now, in fact, multi-layered and complex structure of community dispute resolution that can be escalated in various ways. And in the most extreme circumstances, the foundation will go as far as banning people via court order from the site. But most of it is really community regulation. The community is empowered to block or ban users from editing the site. I think that's good, isn't that the community is really maintaining its own standards. The foundation isn't anywhere near large enough to do it itself. There's just too much interaction. And in part, it's a way to avoid external regulation by letting the community handle it itself, by figuring out what its own rules are before somebody has to step in.
Right.
Do you think it's a different situation on Wikimedia properties, Kat, than it would be on something like Twitter, just because of the huge involvement? I guess this would hold true for Reddit too, of the community and the fact that the community is very vocal. And if someone is misbehaving, they're going to face a lot of pressure from the community to knock it off. I don't know that Twitter has that same community aspect to it, or maybe I'm wrong.
I think the biggest difference is that with both Wikimedia and Reddit is that the community is actually empowered to act themselves. There are mm-hmm. various users who are entrusted with them. They can ban. They don't need to ask anybody who is staff to ban a user. The community can come together and themselves decide it and do it. And there's no involvement by staff. Whereas Twitter, it really is. You report somebody at Twitter. There's no Twitter users who are empowered to do that.
That's right.
Wikimedia, in particular, since it is such, it has an explicit goal, right? You're there to build the encyclopedia, or to on the other sites to build a photo repository, to build a news mm-hmm. site, and it makes it a lot easier to determine what the behavior rules should be. Anything that doesn't act in furtherance of that goal should be banned. Whereas Reddit is much more free-formed; it's a place to discuss ideas. So they actually have a harder time of it, just because it is a place for discussion of ideas that people may find. That people may find those ideas themselves like threatening or hateful or harassing. And when does that reach the point as to let it, when should you just let them discuss those ideas? And when does it arise to the point that it's really threatening members of the community?
Yeah, that, very good points. I think we're ready to talk about one final story before we go ahead and get out of here. And maybe we're all ready to pack up and move to Palo Alto or Woodside. But I don't know if we're going to be able to. So this last story definitely falls into our other category. Clark, I was so glad you brought this to my attention yesterday. It has led to many a chuckle in the aftermath. This is the startup castle that we are discussing. If you haven't heard of it yet, I hadn't heard of it until Clark put it in front of me. This is something that's sort of blown up by a housing listing on a classified ad service for Stanford students, alumni, and staff. And it is this lovely large castle, is a good way to put it, very large home in the environs of Stanford that has been operating for about a year now. I guess you'd have to say in stealth mode. The notion of it is to get a bunch of people who are smart and like-minded, and it's very clear that they want them to be somewhat like-minded, together to be creative with one another. Basically, it's just a living environment. It doesn't say that you have to go there and work on a startup with anybody, but I think that that is the implication. And the really funny aspect of the story and problematic aspect of the story is this classified ads listing of what the requirements are for a potential new resident of the home. And what the suggested, you know, things you might want to think about if you're going to apply to live here. They include things like they don't draw any lines as to what sort of gender you must be, but they do say that if you are someone who enjoys wearing makeup, it would be good if you limited your applications to only twice a week, you know, at most, and various other components of lifestyle that are thrown in here. Very high emphasis on exercise, 15 hours a week. If you're a commuter to anything outside of the castle, and why would you really ever leave the castle? But it's much desired that you not be commuting in a car. You know, bikes would be the desired mode of transportation. Dogs, they're very into dogs. You should really enjoy dogs and all kinds of other things that it's fun to just sort of sit back and laugh at and muse about, you know, the fact that this even exists. James Grimmelman has been posting some pointed tweets about what this says about the current state of elitism in our society and how it sort of hides behind these other factors. I think he's got some strong points there. I also think that if we're in a bubble right now, this just might be its sock puppet of the apocalypse. Clark, since you brought this up, what do you have to add?
Not much, other than I don't qualify, so I'm sort of disheartened by that. But, I mean... You know, I guess maybe this is the algorithm for success, at least that they think they've figured out. But, you know, maybe it will lead to something. Maybe a bunch of like-minded people get together and sort of come up with another Lily camera or something like that. But, you know, I think it's sort of a foolish endeavor. Silly thing, but
yeah. I'm actually kind of stunned the Lily Cam did not emanate from the startup castle. I did, as far as I know, it did not. Kat, are you going to be submitting your application?
I will not, although I will say, you know, I live in Mountain View. I am within bicycle commuting distance to their place. I think it's funny because it is like one part really charmingly earnest and one part insufferable, which is some people that I have met. You know, I see a bunch of people who've just moved out of the dorms at Stanford and have had terrible experiences with housemates and are trying to find people they can live with that they won't want to kill after a month. And I'm really sympathetic to that. And if that's what they've decided are their criteria, that's great. But it is such... I keep feeling that they're eventually going to grow out of this. I don't know who lives in the house, but I feel like maybe none of them are over 25. And they're just trying to find people that they won't want to kill. And this is, and this is how they're doing it.
Yes, exactly. I do think, you know, a lot of the commentary has been about how, well, women seem to be right out of the equation. Anyone without, you know, a top flight, I think is the term that is used, degree is out of the equation. I would say that people above a certain age are probably out of the equation. Sarah, I don't know, is this enticing you out of Iowa?
Oh, God, no. This makes me glad that I left the Bay Area, actually. No, I think it's interesting because it kind of shows the way that, you know, when you say you're defining like a culture of a workplace, to me, it shows how that can be in some ways insidious because you are just trying to get conformity and, you know, not get diversity. Maybe I don't even think it's conscious. I think usually it's subconscious. And like Kat's saying that they're looking for people they don't want to kill. It's probably all in earnest and in good faith. But I think the implications for, you know, conformity are really bad when you do this sort of thing. So no, I will not be moving back and I wouldn't qualify anyway. I definitely don't work out 15 hours a week. So
maybe it would be, you know, it's a great diet plan. You're not supposed to have a complicated diet and you're supposed to work out 15 hours a week. So, you know, it could be, you know, the next Biggest Loser. Oh, the other thing that occurred to me when Biggest Loser, maybe in a couple of different ways. But the other thing that occurred to me when I first saw this is, oh my gosh, you know, I don't know that much about the founders. I've basically skimmed this piece at CNN Money about the people behind this. And its headline is rather incendiary: the ex-stripper and scientist behind Startup Castle, referring to the founder, John Lackness. He was on the short-lived reality show Pirate Master for a while. And that's what occurred to me, too, is, oh, my gosh, how much would a reality TV show pay to put cameras in this place and film the real Silicon Valley? I wonder if that's in their business plan. But anyway, thank you, Clark, for bringing that to my attention. It was quite funny and sad all at the same time. I have a resource and a tip of the week to leave you with before we go on out of here. The resource of the week is sort of an obvious one, but it's not one I had spent any time looking at in any detail until this last week. So I wanted to pass it on to you because I was impressed with it. And that is Facebook's Safety Center, which has different segments for different portions of society who might be concerned with Facebook safety. There's a section for parents, a section specifically aimed at teens, a section for teachers, which I thought was a very, very nice thing for Facebook to do, because I think Facebook as a teacher is particularly fraught with peril. There are ways in which you want to, you know, interact and share classroom things on Facebook. But, you know, if you're interacting with students on Facebook, you've got quite a minefield ahead of you there on the legal front. And it's especially nice. I mean, there's good reminders in there about maintaining the distinction between personal and professional, especially important for teachers who've had all kinds of trouble when their school boards or school employers have not liked the things that they've found out about them in publicly available or not on Facebook. Ashley Payne is someone who went through this several years ago in Georgia when pictures of her surfaced. There we go, if you're watching the video. Traveling to the Guinness factory in Ireland and holding up a couple of steins of beer, and that among other things, led to her termination and a subsequent lawsuit over her termination. So I don't think teachers want to use Facebook and get involved in lawsuits or be terminated. So there's a nice section for teachers there that has suggestions on not specifically how you can avoid those things, but how you can use Facebook in a way that hopefully will not put you in that kind of a situation. And my tip of the week is for folks who go to Starbucks. A lot of us do. Apparently, Starbucks has been, it hasn't been hacked. That's not an accurate way to put it. What has been hacked are various people's Starbucks accounts, where one way or another, someone is brute forcing or otherwise finding out what their passwords are. And then once they're into their Starbucks account, if you're using the app to pay at checkout, what they've done is they've hooked up yet another gift card to these hacked accounts. And then, you know, if you've got it set up to automatically reload as you're going around ordering your lattes, then this is going to draw funds and funnel it into this other gift card. And I guess people have been making off with lots of money this way. So the tip is just to pay attention to what your Starbucks password is. Make it as strong as possible, because this is a thing where people are attempting to get into your account. And as you're having your lattes, they're getting your money. So keep an eye on that. Folks, it's been really, really fun chatting with you on this episode of This Week in Law. Kat and Clark, so great to meet you both. Clark AC at BYU, do you want to get out of here by telling us what's going on with you, things people should keep an eye out for coming up on summer? So I'm sure you're thinking about exams at this point, but are there things going on at BYU that people might be interested in coming by for?
There's actually not at BYU, but there is at American University June 12th. There's a publicly or a public symposium on patent pledges that I'm taking part in. Should be a great group of people talking about Tesla, Toyota, Google, all these other different parties that are pledging their patents to the public, why they're doing it, how they're doing it, and so forth. So that's June 12th at American University. And Google it and you'll find more details about it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Clark. And say hi to your brother. We've enjoyed reading his stuff too.
I'll do.
We will not hire him, though.
Yeah, don't hire him.
Yeah, don't hire him, though. Kat Walsh, great meeting you. Really fun chatting with you today. Congratulations on your new appointment to the board of the Free Software Foundation. Anything you want to leave on people's minds as we sign off today?
Nothing going on particularly on my end, except that the Free Software Foundation is actually having its 30th birthday this year, and there's going to be an event in Boston in early October and possibly other events elsewhere. So, but it was great to be here today. Thanks for having me on.
Wow, that makes me feel old, but that's a great thing. Congratulations, Free Software Foundation. And thank you so much, Kat. It's been so great chatting with you and picking your mind on all of these various topics. Sarah, thank you so much for suggesting we reach out to Kat, and thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, no, I was so excited to have my dear friend Kat on the show. So
very, very cool. Sarah, what's going on with you these days?
We are gearing up to launch a Kickstarter campaign for a book. I say book kind of loosely, an ebook that's going to involve maybe podcasts and Medium blog posts and different things about business models that revolve around CC licensing. We're still kind of figuring out what that looks like, but that's going to launch sometime this summer. I'm spending some time on that. So that's kind of exciting.
Neat. So folks should reach out to Sarah if they have incorporated Creative Commons into their business and are having good experiences with that. Presumably, you want to highlight the good experiences.
Right, yes.
God, that Creative Commons. Why did we ever go that way? I don't think you'd probably find too many of those examples. So I look forward to seeing that, and keep us posted on how it's going, or if you need more information from the TWIT audience, I'm sure they'd be happy to oblige.
Awesome. Yeah, that would be great.
All right. So if you want to reach out to Sarah about that or anything else, anything about the show, she is sarah.h@twit.tv. No, you're Sarah P, aren't you?
Sarah P at twit.tv.
I am denise@twit.tv. You can find us each on Twitter. Sarah is S Hinch Pearson over there. I'm D Howell over there. Also, you should look us up on Facebook or on Google+. Those are great ways to get into touch too. If you have comments or suggestions about the show, things we should be paying attention to, guests we should be thinking about reaching out to, we'd love to hear from you. We really appreciate all of your feedback on the show. We love to hear your responses to the things that we've discussed, your requests for Easter eggs. You know, I'm happy to ask. I'm not saying we're going to get them for you, but never hurts to ask. So, keep them coming. Keep in touch with us between the shows, and watch the shows live with us when you can. We record at 11 o'clock Fridays, 1800 UTC. That's 11 Pacific time. And that's when we do the show live for a couple of hours. But if you can't make that time slot work, don't worry. Head on over to twit.tv/twill. Our archive of shows is there. Or you can find us on YouTube or on Roku or in iTunes or any number of ways. Again, over on our show page, you'll find lots of ways that you can enjoy the show. We're just happy that you do. And thanks so much for joining us this week on This Week in Law.